But I want to come back to that. But something you said there is, I think, particularly important because you talked about the plane I'm on, the plane we're on, and that part of us that is at rest. Now,
Yes.
how do we, there seems to be a gulf. How do we bring them together? How do we get into that area so we're, it's all at rest?
Well, we do that through the techniques which are called the techniques of awakening, meditation, yogic techniques, whatever, study, devotion. They are techniques of extricating ourselves from the identifications, the attachments that keep us feeling limited or keep us being who we think we are. Because we aren't who we think we are. That's really the basic teaching of it all. You aren't who you thought you were. All right, you're just much more than that. And as you extricate yourself from these attachments, it's as if you are going into the space or the ground that lies behind the figures, which are thoughts, the thoughts being the definition of who I am and how the universe is, ego structure, models. You see models as merely models, and you start to rest in your awareness that lies behind the models. It's like you are looking at me now, and if I said, "Who are you?" you could say, "I'm a looker," right? Or you could say, "I am," and there is looking, right? Like, for example, "I am depressed" versus "there's depression." Those are different levels of identification. One, I'm identifying with the depression. I'm depressed. The other is I'm aware that there is depression, and I am in a state of depression. But there is an awareness that is quite independent of that. In that awareness, that spaciousness around the forms is the equanimity.
Okay, well now let's go back in another way, by another path, to what we were talking about earlier. You see, you said this depression. You talked about there's the I am depressed, and there is depression, and I am. Well, now a hell of a lot of people are depressed and
Yes.
hungry and
Yes.
suffering and
Yes.
ill
Yes.
and dying and in prison
Yes.
unjustly and being
Yeah.
beaten on the head by other by wicked people and so on, all around us, all over the world. What do we do about them? Well, let me put it this way: what do you do about them?
Well, what I do about them is I do everything I can to relieve their suffering. I have projects working in prisons. I work with dying people. I work with the blind. I protest against nuclear energy. I do a lot of things that are political active things. I get involved in politics.
Well,
So.
I mean, the two things there that struck me, well, prisons. Now, you work in prison. How?
Yes.
What do you do in a prison?
Well, roughly what we are saying is if you have to serve time, use your time to get free of time. Instead of spending all your time in prison being angry of why you got there, if you take a prison, it gives you a cell, food, clothing, and tells you what to do all day. Take a monastery. It's interesting. They give you a cell, clothing, food, and tell you what to do all day. You say, "Ah, yes, but you were stuck in one and you chose to
Right,
go in."
right.
All right, do you want to spend all the time in prison being preoccupied with how you got there? Or do you want to use the time? And if you can imagine a cell block that has 15 inmates and three guards, and the inmates all think they're in a monastery, the only people left in prison are the guards. I mean, if you could see it that way.
Yeah,
So,
but if you could see it that way, do you make
now,
prisoners see it that way?
what we do is we say to prisoners, there is the possibility you could see it that way. If you would like to see it that way and would like some help in seeing it that way, let us help you. We'll send you material. We'll do everything we can. We'll create a pen pal. We'll do everything we can to give you an environment. We'll give you a free book called Inside Out, which will be telling you about people like Gandhi and Aurobindo and lots of people who serve time in jail and use their time in order to become more conscious. I've met people who've been in solitary confinement, and I look into their eyes and I see an eternality, and I say to them, "How'd you do that?" I mean, these are people that were in death row. And I say, "How are you getting so clear?" And they say, "Well, solitary, man, my." I mean, and that's what, in India, you go and you seek solitude in order to do inner work. And in prisons, you say, "If you're not good, we'll put you in solitude," you see? And you can flip the whole thing around. So the state is actually supporting your becoming a much deeper, more profound, more equanimous person that could actually contribute to the society by bringing peace and love and presence rather than anger and feelings of revenge and so on.
Wherein then does this differ from what we think of as prison visiting? There are plenty of people who work in prisons cheering prisoners up, if you like, trying to make them understand, trying to reform them, if you like, so they will not go back to crime when they're released, etc.
I don't think you'd do anything to another human being. Mm-hmm. I think what you do, Gandhi had a very good image. He was traveling on a train, and a reporter rushed up and said, Mahatmaji, give me a message to take back to my people. And he scribbled on a piece of paper or something and handed it out, and it said, my life is my message. And I think that what you realize is that you work on yourself and you become an environment which allows another person to grow if they are in the point of evolution where they wish to grow. And if they aren't, you leave them alone. You stop coming on to people. I'm not a proselytizer. I got nothing to sell. There's nothing to join. That's not the part of it. For a prisoner, it's merely allowing them to conceive of the possibility that they could use it differently. All right? That's very different than cheering them up.
Right.
Pleasure and happiness is not the business I'm in. Ah. I'm in the business of freedom. Right. It's very different. I'm in the business that Christ was in and that Buddha was in and all of these beings like Muhammad and so on.
Well, now you also met... Now, that, I see that, how that interacts with a prisoner in his trap, in his cell. You also mentioned working with the dying. Yes. Well, you haven't much time there, have you? I mean, a man's dying, a woman's dying, they're dying. And the point about the prisoner in 10 years solitary, he's got time to work through all this, a dying person hasn't, or have they?
Well, you've got to first of all have the image in the Dying Project of where you're going with it. And to give you a feeling for it, let me just tell you this brief story. There was a time when one country was overrunning another, which was Buddhist, and they were being very fierce with the Buddhist monks, disemboweling them and killing them. And there was a particularly fierce commander of the invading army. And when he would come into a town, the monks would all flee into the mountains. And he came into this town, and he asked his adjutant for a report, and the report was all the monks have fled into the mountain but one. And he got furious about this one monk who defied him. And he walked into the monastery and he pushed open the doors and there was the monk standing right in the middle of the courtyard. And he walked up to him and he said, don't you know who I am? I could take my sword and run it through your belly without blinking an eye. And the monk said, and don't you know who I am? I could have your sword run through my belly without blinking an eye. And at that point, supposedly the commander bowed and left, right? Because that's an Eastern country. Now, once you have started to awaken and extricate yourself from identification, one of the first things you break the identification with is your own body. And you see, in India, they call it dropping the body and dying. Mm-hmm. Ramana Maharshi, a great Indian saint, was dying. And his people said, don't leave us, heal yourself. He said, no, this body's all used up. And they said, don't go, don't go. And he looked perplexed and he said, where could I go? I mean, I'm only dropping my body. It's like I'm only selling my Ford. I'm not going anywhere. See, once that identity is broken, so... What I'm looking for is opportunities in life for awakening, for those who wish to awaken, to show them that these are opportunities and help them use them, and help me use them in the same token. So prison is an opportunity for awakening. Relationships are an opportunity. Dying is a beauty because at the point of dying, most of the power trips you've had going start to fall apart. You get to the point you can't even toilet yourself. You can't do anything. You've got to keep letting go and letting go. And every time you let go of your model of who you were and how the world is, you are open. There's a little teeny space in the veil that you could use as a vehicle for awakening. So what we do is we invite those that wish to use their dying as a vehicle for awakening to make contact with us. And then we put them together with people who are working on their awakening and would like to be in the presence of dying people as a vehicle. There are no professional dyers, after all, right? And that combination helps each other keep from getting caught in the drama. Like often I'll walk into a room with somebody and they'll be surrounded by the family and it's all very heavy drama. And I'll say, oh, excuse me, I see you're all, you know, I'm sorry, I'll come back later because I see you're busy dying. Because it's just another storyline. I mean, this sounds callous and cold, but it isn't. It comes, I appreciate the suffering and the pain and the loss and the grief and so on.
But I see the storyline argument in all sorts of fields, but dying can't be a story. Dying's not an illusion.
Dying is a hype.
You die.
Bernard, dying is a hype. You don't die. Just who you think you are dies.
The body dies.
And the
course.
Minute you have died, you say, oh, God, is that what happened? What? And all the time. You know how you dream at night?
Right.
And then sometimes you wake up and you say, oh, that was just a dream. And then you find out you're still in a dream. You're in another dream. Right?
Right?
Well, this one is just another one. And when you wake up, this is like a bigger dream, all right?
You know,
didn't
what?
The people in your dreams seem real?
Right.
Didn't they seem like
right.
you were interviewing
right.
people for BBC?
Right.
Well, it's just another one.
Yes, but a lot of people now want this question answered, and I must say so do I, which is how do you know? You see, you talk that the cycle, the incarnations, the body dies but something else does not
yeah.
die, we go on. When we have died, we think that's what it was and go back again, or you know,
yeah.
round another trip. Well, I'm not saying what is your evidence for this, prove it. No, it's not like that, but
yes.
it is what is it that gives you this conviction? I think you see, you're shining with conviction.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it?
I may well be totally psychotic, Bernard. I mean, I don't know whether... I'm at the point, this is, me as a social scientist is appalled by who I would lock me up. I mean, who I was 50 years ago would lock me up now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't even say I hypothesize or I theorize. I say this is just the way it is.
Right.
And as far as I can see, there are three ways you know these kinds of things. One is by your direct experience and through the drug experiences, through the meditation experiences, through being around my guru and so on, being in India a lot. A lot of things have happened that have reinforced these kinds of belief
yeah.
systems. The second way is that you know somebody who knows and they tell you how it is and you trust them. And that's my relation to my teacher in India, my guru, who died in 73 but didn't go anywhere. I mean, he's more part of my reality now than practically anything else. That's how mashugana I am now. The third one is that you extrapolate from what you know through your studies, all right? Now, some way, in some combination of all those three things, is the way in which it all becomes real in that way, or relatively real. I mean, everything I'm saying is a lie, because words are birds. They're just flying through the space, and the truth has no form. So I know I'm merely playing with words, and everything is just metaphor and image. We're merely the finger pointing at the moon. We're not the moon. You understand? And I'm in this funny business of talking about the unspeakable, you know?
You had a teacher, a guru. Do we all need a teacher? Do we all need a guru?
Well, everybody has as much guidance as they need. It's all happening perfectly. I mean, that's just what's so mind-blowing. The thing is just unfolding for each person so perfectly. And those, nobody, everybody doesn't need an external person that comes along and says, I am a guru, which I am not, no matter what you, how you introduce me, all right? I'm not enlightened, I'm, you know, just working, just like everybody else. I don't think that everybody needs an external guru. A lot of people have internal gurus. There's a Ramana Maharshi said, God, guru, and self are one, right? And so you can go into your own heart and learn to listen deeper and deeper and deeper. We in the West call it the intuitive mind, as opposed to the rational mind. And we've always kind of put it down or said, well, it's kind of soft and mushy. But that, it turns out to be a higher way of knowing. Like Einstein said, I didn't arrive at my understanding of the basic laws through my rational mind. And if you go into people like Mozart or any numbers of musicians, you'll find people go beyond form into the place where music is, where poetry is, where wisdom is, and then come back and bring it back into knowledge or form. All right?
Well, all I can say is if you don't think you're an enlightened man or a teacher, you could have fooled me. Thank you very much, Ramdas.
Thank you.